You found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. The Maria Sanchez Show. Current events, newsmakers, lifestyle, health, relationships, entertainment. Miss a day? Download the podcast at LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. It's an honor and a privilege to be with you each and every morning at 9 o'clock right here at LATalkRadio.com, Channel 2. And then later every day, the podcast is available for download via iTunes and also at MariaSanchezShow.com and LATalkRadio.com. So we appreciate the emails, and we appreciate the programming suggestions, and we follow up on, well, we respond to every email, and that would be we follow up on as many of your suggestions as possible. That helps make our programming the eclectic array that we do have. So we thank you for that. Our first guest this morning is Dr. Pepper Schwartz. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Washington and the author or co-author of 17 books, the latest of which is called The Normal Bar, but she's visiting with us because she has a nice take about what the Iowa Supreme Court ruled. Basically, they said it's okay to fire a female employee if she's attractive. I'll just give you the overview. So we're going to have that conversation with her, and she's going to weigh in on her take about that. She's also the AARP Love and Relationship Ambassador and writes the Naked Truth column for AARP.org, and she's a senior fellow at the Council on Contemporary Families, a nonprofit organization that gathers research on American families, and chief expert for PerfectMatch.com. So she's got a lot going on. And then later on this hour, we have George Farrell back on the program. He visited with us last month. He's the author of the Strong Black Men series of books. He's going to be speaking to us about President Obama's comments about the Zimmerman trial. And speaking of George Zimmerman, he's in the news again today, and this time for being an ambassador of goodwill. Yet, and why is he in the news today? He did something last Wednesday, and it made news. It's making news today because the Seminole County Sheriff's Office released something yesterday that according to Sheriff's spokesperson Heather Smith, folks made 911 calls, and they were called to a crash at about 5:45 p.m. on Wednesday. A Ford Explorer with two children and their parents inside had gone off the road and rolled over into the area of Interstate 4 and State Road 46. By the time a deputy had arrived, George Zimmerman and another man had already helped get the family out of the overturned vehicle. George Zimmerman was not a witness to the crash, and he left after making contact with the deputy, and then he just went back into his quiet little hiding life. So his attorney, Mark O'Mara, was contacted yesterday and made a statement. He didn't know about it, and they said, why don't you think he told you about it? And he said, because this exemplifies who George Zimmerman is. His quote is, it's just in his nature. I just wish people would look at this and understand this is who he is. So the authorities also released several 911 calls reporting the crash. The callers described that the vehicle was on its side and that there were bystanders helping. No one mentioned George Zimmerman specifically in the audio. They just talked about the conditions. And then it turns out that that was him, that he rushed to rescue. So if the story keeps fleshing out, and the mentoring of young black folks and the fact that he had a couple of black children living with him when he was growing up, all of that's become news to me. So that's the kind of stuff that we're hearing now. So I ask everybody to keep an open mind. So Pope Francis is visiting Brazil in South America, and he refused to bring the Pope Mobile. He said it was going to keep him too far removed from the people. His security is pretty lax or low, and he's creating frenzies where he went yesterday. So what happened also is that his driver made a wrong turn, and it put him right into a mob, if you will, of people just screaming and crying and reaching out, and he couldn't be more delighted. They said other parts of his route weren't lined with fencing and gave the people more chances to get close, with uniformed police nowhere in sight to act as crowd control. The three dozen visible Vatican and Brazilian plainclothes security officers struggled to keep the crowds at bay, but the Pope not only looked calm, but got even closer to the people. He rolled down his backseat window. He waved to the crowd. He touched those who reached inside. He kissed a baby a woman handed to him. His secretary was afraid, but the Pope was happy. So he's there on a seven-day visit. Meant a lot of it has to do with the church's World Youth Day. They're saying as many as a million young people from around the world are expected in Rio for the Catholic Youth Festival. And that his raucous welcome in Rio was the beginning of what should prove to be a historic visit. He's going to be doing some, well, yesterday he greeted the president, Dilma Rousseff, and he said that he knew to really know Brazilians, one must pass through their heart. So here's his quote. "So let me knock gently at this door. I have neither silver nor gold, but I bring with me the most precious thing given to me, Jesus Christ." He also said on the plane ride en route to Rio that he felt sorry for the entire generation of young people that wanted to work, but in the economic crisis had not been able to work, and that the youth unemployment skyrocketed and it left a lot of people poor in the developing world. And he said people get their dignity from work. They earn their bread. Young people this moment are in crisis. So his schedule is going to be about focusing on the poor. He's going to walk through one of Rio's shanty towns or favelas, and he's going to meet with juvenile offenders. He's also going to pray at Aparecida, which is a reference to his strong Marian devotion that is shared with many in Latin America, and that would mean to honor Mary, the Mother of God, which she, a lot of people confuse Catholics for thinking that we rever her as much as we do, you know, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, and that's not true, but we are devout and devoted to her because of what she is and who she is. And then he's going to preside over a procession that reenacts Christ's crucifixion on the beach of Copacabana, which they say is ground zero for Rio's Sin City. So a poll that was published Sunday in their newspaper said that 57% of Brazilians aged 16 and older call themselves Catholic, the lowest ever recorded, as opposed to in 1980 when Pope John Paul II came to visit Brazil, 89% listed themselves as Catholics. So that's quite the decline. Locally in the United States, the sergeant, Sean Murphy, who released the photos without authorization, will face a closed-door hearing today to determine his professional future with the Massachusetts State Police. The Boston Magazine, who published the photographs that he released to them last week in a story and is going to publish more in their September issue, said that Boston Magazine published them. He's the tactical photographer that 51,000 people have thrown their support behind him because of his temporary suspension and what he's going to go through today. He's going to go before three commissioned officers who will decide if he will remain on full or restricted duty pending an investigation or suspended with or without pay during the probe. So there's a Save Sergeant Murray Facebook page, and the gal who started it, she would only list her first name as Lisa. She said she felt compelled to create the page because her own father is a, or was a Massachusetts State Police trooper. And she says she's been getting emails from all over the world. She expected that, you know, it would be something that only the United States would be paying attention to. She says, "I thought this page would only be popular among my friends, but I'm getting private messages from people across the country, in Germany and in England, all over, who believe this trooper did the right thing. I was so angry when I heard that Sergeant Murphy was going to suffer for trying to stand up for the victims." So Boston Magazine said, and they quoted Murphy, that he was not speaking as a representative of the Massachusetts State Police. He was sharing his personal thoughts about the Rolling Stone magazine cover. And John Wolfson, Boston Magazine's editor-in-chief, said the magazine has hundreds of photos similar to the ones Murphy provided and will publish more in its September issue. He said, the editor, that Sergeant Murphy was conflicted on some level after releasing the photos, but genuinely worried about how the Rolling Stones cover will affect the victim's family. And as we reported last week, five major chains said that they would not sell the magazine, which hit the shelves on Friday of last week. Three of them prominent New England-based businesses, CVS Pharmacies, Stop and Stop, and Tadeshi Food Shops. Also, 7-Eleven said that its nearly 1,700 company stores across the country would not sell the issue. So, of course, the cover, if you haven't heard, is with Jorge Tsarnaev looking young, sexy, attractive on the cover with his tousled hair. And the pictures that Sergeant Sean Murphy released to Boston Magazine were the ones that were taken as he was apprehended in that boat with a red laser beam going onto his forehead and bloodied and disheveled. We've got much more news, including female genital mutilation or cutting is in the news. And we do have a circumcision expert that visits with us about that topic when it's in the news because UNICEF released a report about it. We'll go into more details later. But they say that more than 125 million girls and women alive today have undergone some form of female genital mutilation in 29 countries across Africa and the Middle East, and that if something isn't done, more than 30 million more girls are at risk of being cut over the next decade. So now we'd like to bring on the line Dr. Pepper Schwartz, a CNN op-ed editorialist, and so much more.
The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation, on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Hello, Dr. Pepper Schwartz. Thank you so much for making yourself available to the program. You're live and on the air, and we appreciate your time. You're East Coast. No, no, you're in Washington.
So you're West Coast.
Yeah, it's good morning to you, too. Thank you. We're going to go into your op-ed piece with CNN about the Iowa Supreme Court decision, and I'd also like to get some of the normal bars, promote that, as well as to talk about your work with ARP and PerfectMatch.com, because you got a lot going on. I shared with our listeners about the fact that you're a professor of sociology at the University of Washington and the author or co-author of 17 books, the latest of which is The Normal Bar. But first, would you give the listeners, our listeners, the background on the case that made itself all the way up to the Iowa Supreme Court and then their ruling?
Well, the basic outlines of the case are the fact that a woman had worked in a dental office as an assistant for 10 years. She was a nice-looking woman, but the dentist who worked with her thought she was knocked down so gorgeous that he felt that her very presence endangered his marriage because of his temptations. Now, it's also said in the brief that she neither flirted with him nor did they have any kind of sexual or emotional relationship other than professional. But he fired her on the grounds that she endangered his marriage, and she was so outraged, and some supporters were so outraged, that they sued for wrongful termination. And this thing went all the way up to the Iowa Supreme Court, where the Iowa Supreme Court decided that it was allowable for him to fire her for that particular cause, that he was worried about his marriage, and that she had no further rights to sue. And that was that.
So if I didn't read this or hear this from you again, I would think that you had made this ridiculous fairy tale that men can't help themselves and that not only is there lust in their heart, it's in their loins. And so anybody who's attractive, that doesn't matter what your skill set is or how good of an employee you are, by being attractive, you're just bait and you're just an accident waiting to happen.
I am so terribly sorry that you have totally correctly analyzed this issue, which is why I wrote a CNN blog basically saying the same thing, that I could not believe that the court decided this was not a gender issue. This was just a personal choice that the doctor had, that the dentist had made. And, you know, basically it means that women are, are in trouble if they're not attractive enough. There are jobs like, God forbid anyone would want it, but Hooters, where you can't go unless you fit into shorts a certain way. And now there are jobs you can't do because you're just too beautiful, or somebody decides you're just too beautiful. And it is a gender issue in my mind, because this doesn't happen to men. Men don't get hired for their looks unless they're movie stars, and they don't get fired for them either. And so something that can only happen to women, and it's been, women's looks and their weight and everything, whether it was being stewardesses in the old days, et cetera, has been a gender issue for as long as the feminist movement's been going on. So the fact that the court ignored that, it was all male court, need I add, and that this woman is now allowed to be fired after having what everyone says was a flawless employee for 10 years, is actually, as you say, sort of beyond imagination. If we had to bet on which way the court would have gone, I don't think any one of us could have imagined this outcome.
Well, and you mentioned that as an aside, she had been an employee for 10 years. I mean, this isn't new. And I'm assuming that if she's attractive now, she was attractive 10 years ago.
Well, and probably according to this guy's values, even more so. So somehow he resisted her for 10 years, but at the end of 10 years, you know, he could no longer withhold his lust. And as you in my opinion, correctly said, what this does is go back to that old saw that men just can't be responsible for their sexual urges. You know, I truly thought that when we had fought all the rape issues and we made rape, you know, a huge issue and one that many, many women now have cause and get satisfactory reactions from the court with, because we don't believe that men are entitled to act on their sexual urges merely because they feel one. Well, this seems to be perilously close to that.
And I was going to ask you that. Does this not now open up opportunities in that regard, that in Iowa, at least, men can't help themselves, so it's up to the woman, the onus is on the woman to protect herself?
You know, I mean, I think if I were, you know, an attorney who was defending a rape defendant, you know, I would certainly say that, you know, the thing that got thrown out of other courts, well, she was wearing a short skirt, Your Honor, she had cleavage,
right.
Your Honor. You know, of course he couldn't help himself. It's their fault if they're going to look like tramps. I mean, that's, to me, very much in line with this decision.
So do you know, I haven't heard about the reaction in the state. There seems that it's like, oh, well, the men have spoken and on we go. Have you heard about any protests or uprisings or movements or petitions or anything?
You know, I really haven't. I can't believe the ACLU hasn't bemoaned it in their newsletters, and I'm sure some feminist organizations have been outraged, but I you would think, let me tell you, I'm in Seattle, we'd be in the streets.
Yes.
So I think maybe Iowa is used to conservative decisions and maybe they're dispirited, but no, I haven't heard of anything big. Now, that of course does not mean it didn't go on, it just didn't get covered, which of course would be another issue.
Yes, a much other issue, because you mentioned also as an aside that I'd like to double back to, that the Iowa Supreme Court is all men.
Yeah, and there was a reason that women fought to get women in high positions of the judiciary and other parts of American life, because, in fact, it has changed the way decisions are made. The fact that the Supreme Court of the United States has three women on it makes a difference, and I think that I think we bring a different perspective, a different life experience, and of course the same intellect as the other people who gain these kind of high offices. So the fact that there are no women in decision-making position there makes a really big difference.
Well, and you know, Dr. Schwartz, what I think is the slippery slope, at least in Iowa now, is beauty's in the eye of the beholder. So you could get fired now for being beautiful, whether that's true or not, since it's all about perception, right? It's not like you have to be 5'9 and weigh 135 pounds and have blonde hair and blue eyes, and then you're deemed beautiful, and therefore you can get fired.
Well, I wondered about that. I mean, of course it's in the eye of the beholder, but I wonder then if the judges are going to decide, if they can decide if she's truly beautiful or beautiful enough. I mean, you can see where it sends us. It sends us into using something indefinable as definable and using it against or for or however you want to use it with women. And obviously then men could ask for gender equity and, you know, say, I was fired for being too handsome. I mean, it's nutty. It's just nutty.
You as a sociologist, though, I would imagine that this has to perplex you more than the average person, because, I mean, I don't get it, but you study this kind of things, the behavior of the human experience. So I don't, and there's nothing to do once the Supreme Court weighs in, right? Unless it could go to the U.S.
Supreme Court. Somebody else could go to the U.S. Supreme Court. But, of course, you know, to bring a case to the United States Supreme Court is an extremely expensive endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
And then what's in it for, you know, I suppose the ACLU and organizations like that are active for precisely those kinds of situations. Whether they will strike out with this or not, I mean, I would hope. I would send them some money on it. You know, I think what it says to me, you know, putting on my sociological hat rather than my woman's, is that we're still deeply ambivalent about women's role in society.
Mm-hmm.
And that the fact is that these judges felt that the sanctity of marriage, which was mentioned a couple times in the decision, was the overwhelming factor, not the sense of this woman's right to work. They didn't see the importance of this as an employment case. And, you know, if she wasn't being fired from a job, if this was somebody's just, you know, I don't want her at my party. Well, okay, who cares? But the fact is the right to work for women has been hard fought. And I think as a society, we felt that, you know, gender equality and equity was approaching. What this shows us is that women's right to work is not the highest thing in some courts, but rather, you know, various kinds of other institutional sacredness. And in this case, they used marriage. But what it said is that women's equality in the places that it matters, like putting bread on the table, is not safe nor agreed upon at this time.
Well, Nancy Pelosi started something, and again, it was an op-ed on CNN about that women need, she wants to empower women to be able to provide more, and that single mothers are at more risk than most, and that today women are still making 77 cents on the dollar to what their male colleagues are. So there's more parity, but it's certainly not 50-50 or even. And
well, I tell you why. I mean, we're still seeing, women are still not seen as, their employment is not seen as valuable, even when they're as valuable and when they're doing the same job, and they're still underemployed in places that, you know, there's really no reason for them to be underemployed. There was a time when there were very few women in the pipeline, and so be it. You know, it takes a while to catch up. But right now, I think we're still looking at some deep-seated feelings about women and employment and their right to go to the top.
And I would imagine that this gal, who she actually sued for sex discrimination, which to me seems like a slam dunk, since everybody has acknowledged that it wasn't about what she was doing professionally, I get, you know, it's like, really, you want me to wear my hair in a ponytail, no makeup, and put braces on so that that'll make me less? I mean, like, really. But what she must be wondering, I mean, what, so somebody, like, sue me because I'm attractive? That's my fault? I mean, we don't have control over how we come out of the womb. So she doesn't have anything to do about that. You know, it's the dressing.
Yeah, I really do feel that, you know, sometimes it's baby steps forwards, you know, and baby steps backwards. I think this one has ignited enough conversation around the country, maybe not Iowa, but certainly around the country, to now have judges think about it themselves. You know, judges get a lot of continuing education, and people in law school also get these cases to think about and to talk about, and I often feel that we just have to wait for a generation to pass, including my own, because I think that the feelings about people who are younger are much better on these kinds of topics, and I think eventually we will get to full parity. There's no doubt that using a woman's looks as reason enough to fire her is, you know, kind of a medieval finding, mm-hmm. Certainly not up to the kinds of findings the courts had in other areas of employment. fairness. So, you know, I see this as an archaic moment, not the future. But I feel very badly for this woman. And I think the issue of women's looks needs to be debated more because I think it is a huge issue in how women are treated and their vulnerabilities. Whoever thought you'd have a vulnerability of being too good looking? I think women have often suffered by not, you know, fitting somebody's vision of how they ought to look as a waitress, a receptionist, et cetera, or on the newsroom. I mean, you know, try and find an older woman anchor.
Right.
And don't tell me it's because they suddenly, you know, became incompetent. But somebody at the top decided they had to look a certain way. So mm-hmm. I hope a dialogue on women's looks and their right to work, not just how it works in emotional relationships, but their right to work and to keep their jobs becomes a bigger dialogue because it's very important.
You know, what's interesting, though, about you speaking of a generation perhaps that it's going to have to cycle through is that the younger women don't really know about the struggles that our generation has gone through and things that I've seen firsthand. For example, when I started playing basketball in grade school, it was six girls to a side. Four couldn't go full court, only two, because we were fragile. And I mean, it's, and I'm not that old. So it's, I've seen that. I've seen my mom go to rent an electric power tool and be denied that because she was a woman. So the other gals didn't, they don't know that. So I don't know. It's like some of the gay or young people, they don't know what their forefathers have gone through and fought for. And so I don't know how we're going to be able to put it in perspective for them because I'm also a member of Rotary. It went to the U.S. Supreme Court to let women in, and that was 20 years ago.
I know. It's remarkably recent where some of these, you know, we don't want women in for X, Y, and Z reason, which to me generally comes down, we just don't feel comfortable about them. These things have changed, and most people, I think, who go to Rotary now would say it's better. It's fun having these other women professionals in there. Brings a different perspective. So, I mean, it is relatively recent that big changes have taken place. And I think that's cause for hope in the sense that when you look at, you know, what the country was like at our founding, which is, you know, 1776, not that far away.
Right.
And how long gender inequity was in place until this real resurgence of what was only a partially effective women's movement in the late 19th century. And early 20th, I think actually we've made a lot of social change in a fairly speedy way. However, now with the internet, with everything changing, you know, underneath us daily, it feels so slow compared mm-hmm. to a technological change. And yet I would say, as somebody, you know, who was, you know, in the first wave of feminism, you know, in the late 60s, you know, I would say that I get a great deal of satisfaction from the progress that women have made in both interpersonal and professional ways. It's not where it should be, and I usually think it's going, you know, right in the right direction at a fairly steady pace. And then you get something like this, and then you say, well, there are still, you know, very deep-seated feelings about what women's rights are and compared to, you know, other rights. And I still think there's certain resentment and lack of understanding about how women don't quite get the same treatment as men do, and sometimes, you know, a huge injustice like I think this one is. I think we are thinking differently about rights. I mean, I take some satisfaction in thinking about the change in America's attitudes towards gay people.
Mm-hmm.
I think they've been really hounded and treated badly and deprived of even basic rights and lots of myths about them. And now, particularly among younger people, they're going like, what's the big deal, you know? So they're not heterosexual. It's okay with us. And I think watching that movement where we accept each other more and we want to give each other basic rights, again, to employment, to housing, to live our lives without fear of persecution, you know, I think we're going in the right direction. And then you get some troglodyte finding like this one, and you go, well, not so fast, but correct.
But I hope your earlier statement about, you know, a few steps forward and then maybe one step back so that we can at least continue in the momentum in the right direction. I would like to switch gears with you and talk about your book, The Normal Bar, The Surprising Secrets of Extremely Happy Couples on Crown Random House. Can you share some of the secrets?
Oh, sure. This study is about 90,000 people in 10 countries, most prominently, of course, in the United States, done on five very different cyber sites, as well as a main site for the book. And we were looking at, you know, everybody has their normal day. Some people get up and have coffee. Some people don't. Some people, you know, have a dog. Some people don't. Everybody has a different normal. But we were thinking about what is the normal that extremely happy couples have. And we asked people if they were anything from unhappy to extremely happy, and we thought people who went over happy to extremely happy probably really were, mm-hmm. because we didn't want anybody who said they were happy. We were kind of sort of happy, you know?
Right.
So one of the things we found about extremely happy is how many affectionate and publicly affectionate behaviors they do. They say, "I love you" every day. They kiss, they cuddle, they write each other notes, they give each other gifts much more than other couples do. In fact, Americans are really kind of snarky about giving gifts. Women rarely give men gifts compared to men giving women gifts, and we're nothing compared to France, Italy, Spain. They're much more romantic than we are. They do many more of these behaviors than we do. So I would just say, just in terms of, you know, holding hands, extremely happy couples hold hands a lot more than other couples. You know, and everyone says, well, you know, maybe that's happy couples produce that. But I also think doing that helps produce an extremely happy couple. And, you know, maybe the easiest thing I could say here is, you know, okay, try a few of these things and see if it doesn't help your relationship.
So act as if an emotion will follow behavior?
Yeah. If someone holds your hand, you immediately have to make a decision. Either kind of melt into it, you know, even if it's a friend, you know, to take it as an act of solidarity, or to withdraw it. And withdrawing it's a big issue. You know, I mean, if you take, somebody holds your hand, you withdraw it. You've made a big statement.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times, okay, we'll hold hands. There's a lot of research to show that holding hands lowers cortisol levels, raises oxytocin, which is the bonding hormone. I mean, there's a physiological positive response just by that. And maybe what happens in a lot of long-term couples is they start getting efficient. They forgot to act like lovers, you know, or don't hold hands whether they're eating or walking to the movies or something. And they still like each other. They still love each other, but they don't do those things anymore. And I think they would be surprised about how you could get from, you know, sort of happy to very happy with just a few little changes. Are really happy couples do PDAs. They do public displays of affection, one of which is holding hands, and they make a difference.
What about sex? Where did that fall in?
Well, the more the better. you know, basically.
Men need to hear
you want the bottom line?
That's one of my adages, too. Every moment
really
is
true.
A missed opportunity.
Oh, there you are, a happy woman. And it's true. It's true. A lot of people treat sex, you know, like salt. You have to be very sparingly with it, you know? You know, not too much salt. Well, it's not like that. You know, this is something you can't overdo, really, if you're both on the same page. And the idea of, again, all the hormonal benefits you get, all the health benefits you get, all the reassurance and ratification you give each other. Sex has a lot of benefits, and it's not just an orgasm, although that's pretty cool, too. The idea of this kind of connection is why you are special to each other. It's the thing that at least most of us only do with the person that we made this commitment to or the person we are committed to in other ways without a ceremony. And I just think that when sexuality starts to attenuate, you really, really have to pay attention to it and get professional help if you have to. Yes, there are people where both of them are uninterested in sexuality, but rarely. Usually maybe one person is and one person isn't. And I often say, particularly young people, you know, women are more likely to be the person who's, you know, withholding sex for various reasons or uninterested, angry, bored, whatever the good reason is, maybe. But, you know, I go like, do you think he's going to, like, sign up to be celibate for the rest of the marriage? I don't
right.
think so.
Right. That I wonder about that, too. I think, what are you thinking? I mean, really, not that it's an excuse, but it's I think it's a part of the human expression or the experience. And I know couples that they've shared with me, men and women, that they've gone, I know one man, he said it's been 8 years, and he's a buddy of mine, so that's not like he's looking for an opportunity. And then I have a girlfriend that was 20 years without sex. And it's like, I always wonder, how does a day turn into a week, turn into a month, turn into a year, and then into years?
Well, and that's kind of how it happens. They go through a rough period. You know, maybe one of them's been sick, or one of them was unfaithful, or they, you know, had a series of tragedies happen in their extended family, or they got depressed, or they got alcoholic, or something where one of them or both of them withdrew from each other, and yet they stayed for the kids, or they do care about each other, and they start to get so separate that they don't even know how to start again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've known many couples just like the ones you're talking about. A gulf, a divide happens, which, you know, they would need clinical intervention to help overcome, because they become such physical strangers to one another.
Well, and I'm sure ego is involved, and no one wants to be rejected, and it's like, well, why should I always be the one, and all that stuff. But it just seems to me that how could it not be a recipe for disaster?
Well, it is, even just internally. I mean, a part of you dries up, that sort of juicy, awake, erotic part of you isn't being utilized, and it's designed in us. It's part of our DNA. It's part of our physiology. I often tell people, so if you didn't use your left arm for 20 years, what do you think would happen? You know, it's not going to work anymore, and you need it.
Right, right.
So this is part of your body. It's part of your blood delivery system.
To use it or lose it, right?
Well, and when you lose it, you lose more than an orgasm. You lose more than the connection. You literally start to have an endocrine system that isn't working.
I cannot thank you enough for the conversation, Dr. Schwartz. I really admire you from afar, and now even more so. So thank you for your time, really. It's been fabulous. And good luck with everything. We'll the normal bar, the surprising secrets of extremely happy couples, your latest endeavor.
Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
You're so welcome. Take care. Dr. Pepper Schwartz, and she wrote an editorial for CNN op-ed last week about the Iowa Supreme Court, and she agreed to be a guest on our program. And what a diverse and fascinating woman. We're going to shift gears right now to our next guest, which is George Farrell, best-selling author of Strong Black Men, and he's going to be visiting with us about President Obama's remarks on the George Zimmerman trial.
Start your workday off right with the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Hello. Please leave a message after
boy.
The tone.
Let's try again. Live Rob Radio. Thank you, Ronnie, for making this possible. And you do have... No, the number was wrong. Oh, no, you're right. The number's right.
The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation, on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
We did confirm this with his publicist. Hi, George. Good afternoon to you. It's Maria Sanchez. We called the other number, but it went to your voicemail. So are you okay with us on this number?
No, this is still a little breakup. Let me call you back on the 661. I'll call you right back.
Okay. He's going to – thank you. Ronnie, he'll call you back in studio. He has that number. So you see – this is what happens when when we schedule things, the best laid plans, but it's all right. So we've got other news about how important it is to eat breakfast. That they did a study, the Harvard School of Public Health studied men aged 45 to 82 for 16 years, 27,000 men. And they said those who skipped breakfast were at a greater risk of heart problems. And it is, they said that men who skipped breakfast were 27% more likely to have heart problems than those who started the day with the meal. And they adjusted for lifestyle risk factors such as smoking and exercise. So the take-home message is eat in the morning when you wake up, preferably within an hour. We also have other news about calorie counting and people who exercise and then what they do after they exercise and how that is contributing to the obesity epidemic that's affecting more than a third of the U.S. adults. So George is supposedly calling the studio. Not sure, as he's not calling my number. And hopefully he's getting through to Ronnie at the board, who's running the board. She's making it all possible, technically. There we go. Hi, George. Thank you for calling us back.
Hi, Maria. How are you today?
I'm excellent. How about yourself?
I'm great.
Good. Thank you for taking the time to visit with us, the best-selling author of Strong Black Men series of books, George Farrell. And you have some perspective about the President Obama's remarks about race and the George Zimmerman trial. And I was curious to hear what you have to say about that.
Okay. Everyone's talking about this, and I'm not supposed to talk about race anymore.
We're just listening to your opinion.
But I will talk about his remarks.
Okay.
They were great remarks. They were unexpected from all sides. A lot of people were shocked, as was I. But it actually is a very cunning way to take attention off of other more important issues like unemployment and the economy, and get people focused somewhere else that really has nothing to do with the ongoings of the country. Well, it does and it doesn't. President Obama is a major hypocrite in this African-American issue. He has hired and appointed less African-Americans than Bush, than Carter, than Clinton, than Reagan. His hiring record among African-Americans is abysmal, to say the least. And if he really wants to do something about African-Americans in their condition in the U.S., he needs to lead by example. He needs to hire. He needs to promote. He's appointed six ambassadors. None of them were African-American. Actually, I believe his last six ambassador appointments were openly gay, which I don't have a problem with that, but you have to say that after you say that.
You're the facts, and I don't have an accent right.
Right. But you have to, I just think his remarks were very hollow once you look at them in terms of the condition. I mean, he could have done a lot more, a lot sooner. Hopefully he improves. And if you see where all the murders are, his hometown of Chicago with the Rahm Emanuel from his White House, who's now the mayor of Chicago, they haven't come up with any solutions for employment or for the horrendous murder rate in Chicago. So I think his remarks seem a little hollow. A lot of people are glad he made them. A lot of people are saying now he's an African-American president. I still say that, I hold him to a different standard, but I haven't seen him really do a lot for African-Americans. Not even, let's take out the race part, the African-American part, because I'm not supposed to talk about race, but student loan rates going up, doubling, that hurts a lot of young people. 13% unemployment or 6% unemployment, that hurts a lot of people. Chicago or Detroit filing for bankruptcy, again, that hurts a lot of people. And hopefully the story of Detroit does not become the story of America. Mm-hmm. That could be a warning bell. Where we're paying and paying and paying for programs that we cannot afford.
Well, what I found interesting about his remarks is that he made his experience more human. I don't know how true it is since he did have somewhat of a privileged lifestyle, but I know men in my life who I've dated that were of color, and they said that they driving while black was an issue. And so our dates would always end before midnight because otherwise there was going to be too much attention as they were driving home. And I'm talking just in the last several years. So what he talked about, you know, doors locking, car doors, that sort of thing, and, you know, a second glance at you in a store on the street or whatever, I'm sure that that's still in existence today. But what does that have to do with the Zimmerman trial?
Well, it has nothing to do with the Zimmerman trial. And yes, those things do happen. I mean, that's part of the reason that young Trayvon was targeted, because he was seen as somebody that was causing trouble and dangerous. That still happens in the U.S. But you can't let it define your life. That, you know, and having someone say, oh, I don't want to be on the road after 12 o'clock, you know, you're letting it define your life. And that's where it becomes where you're paranoid. And you see racism in everything. And I don't want to talk about racism. But when you become paranoid and you see it in everything, that's where it becomes a problem. We've got to get to a point where we don't see it in everything, where we don't make it define our very existence. And that's why I don't really want to talk about it anymore. I don't want it to define my very existence on Earth, that every waking moment I'm taking precautions because I might be a victim of racism. It's like a fixed factor in a business. If it's fixed and you know it's going to happen, you factor it into it and you make adjustments for it, but it doesn't become your defining life. It doesn't become the only thing that you worry about day in and day out.
Well, how does your series of books, The Strong Black Men, fit into this prism now of how you're viewing the world?
Well, I still view the world the same way. It's actually the best-selling one is The Angry Black Man's Guide to Success. And what we go into is we try to find the motivating anger. I think we explained it before with LeBron James. What is going to motivate you to do better but not self-destruct? And how do you reach into that motivation and get on the right path? Do you write down your goals? Do you have 5 goals that you write down? Do you put it on your mirror and every morning you see those 5 goals and you move a little bit more to them? It may be improving your education. It may be getting a commercial driver's license. Anything that's improving your lifestyle from where you are now to where you want to be. And how do you move toward those goals? But you can't let racism, defeating racism, be one of your goals. It's just not going to happen.
And in terms of younger folks coming up, how do you advise or mentor them?
Advise a lot of young African-American males. And again, I'd reach into their anger. I tell them to think about the person that tells them that they're not going to succeed. Think about the person that tells them they're not going to be anything. Think about the teacher or even someone in your family that just looks at you and say, that boy ain't never going to be no good. You know, look at that person and decide to prove them wrong. That could be your motivating anger. So when I talk to young people, I talk about finding your motivating anger, defining the goals that you want. If it's something that you want to do in the arts, do it in the arts. You write it down. You put down the 5 things that you want to achieve within the next 12 months, and you look at that every day, whether it's art, whether you want to become a rapper, whether you want to become a doctor, whether you want to become a lawyer. Look at those 3 things, and as you let other people know what you're looking to achieve, even that negative person that's saying you're not going to do it, let everyone know, hey, I'm trying to do this, and people will start to help you. Miraculously, if you want to achieve something that's positive in your life and you let the people around you know, I'm trying to graduate from high school, let your teacher know I really want to graduate. Let your counselors know I really want to graduate. Let everyone know that you really want to graduate and you want to get a higher GPA level. Some people will step out of their comfort zone and start to help you. Some people will start meeting you at the library. You'll fall into a group that really wants to reach the same goals as you do as a young person. But you've got to let people know what your goals are. You've got to look at them every day. You've got to have them well-defined, and you put them within a 12-month period. And that's what I tell young people. I also teach young people how to get stopped properly in public and during traffic stops.
Nice.
So, well, you have to cover all bases. You have to, and young people have a lot of tattoos. I don't judge people with tattoos. I don't judge a lot of young people with dreads or whatever, because some of the folks with dreads are the most creative people I've ever met in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Or the tattoos. But you do have to teach young people how to interact with police officers, and hopefully it'll be a temporary thing. It won't be something that becomes a major issue in their life. So one of the things we used to do with kids, and actually used to tick cops off, is the minute a cop walked toward us, we would actually turn around and put our hands on the wall.
Wow.
That sounds foolish, and it sounds silly, but what it did was it ticked the cop off, and then he didn't want to bother you.
Interesting. But you're also creating acquiescence. It, like an animal who shows their belly. It's like, I don't have anything to hide, and I'm...
And you have to do that as a young person. If you're in an area that's questionable, maybe your neighborhood's not good. Sometimes it's the best way to do. I mean, if you stand there and say, what are you stopping me for? You make the situation worse. You escalate the situation. As young people, and this is no matter what the color, if you're in an area of high police presence, sometimes you just have to do that. As young kids, when a police officer just started walking toward us, and whether we're just sitting there as a group of three or four young men, we would just stand up or whatever we were doing and turn around and put our hands on the wall. And the cops would look at that and say, oh, you're right. Yeah. We were getting ready to bother you, but we don't want to bother you now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you very practical, George. And when we post the podcast today, we'll put georgefarrell.blogspot.com for folks to get in touch with you if they have questions.
Yes, yes.
Thank you so much for your time again. We do appreciate it.
Thank you, Maria. I appreciate you, too. And enjoy sunny California.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. George Farrell, and that's the Maria Sanchez program. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day. We look forward to visiting with you mañana.